My name is Mark Schwain, and I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana. And I teach at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana, where I'm the Dean of the Honors College. And my background is in history of ideas and humanities. And for a long time, I've been teaching courses there. Most of our junior and senior level courses are interdisciplinary courses. And so I've taught one on a problem, the problems involved in love and friendship, and have been doing some sessions up here at Holden on those subjects for the past couple of weeks. And this is the last one in a series of two-week classes on love and friendship. The good news is each one of these is self-contained, and so you don't have to have attended the others in order to make sense of what's going to happen this morning. I'll say a little bit about why I chose this particular topic for Holden on this particular summer, and then I'll do a little bit of review, that is, recapitulate a little bit of some of the things that we have talked about in previous classes. But I will select things we've talked about in order to point us to today's topic, which has to do with whether or not the Christian love, agape, is something that's complementary to, or somehow something that's in tension with, the other loves, the loves eros and the love philia, or friendship. So in a way, the major question that we want to think about today is the question of the relationship between Christian love and the other kinds of love that most of us here have known and experienced at some time or another throughout our lives. So first, a little bit about why I selected this topic, apart from the fact that it happens to be a course that I teach. The summer theme, as you all know, is no longer strangers. And I thought that love would be about as close to the opposite of estrangement or alienation as you could come. And therefore, to think together about the different kinds of love might be a way of thinking about the relationship between love on the one hand and alienation or strangerhood on the other. Last week, mostly we talked about eros. And I took up on the first class period a text which came out of ancient Greece, and without going into great detail about that text, in one of the Platonic dialogues, suffice it to say that the text told a very interesting story whose major point was that erotic longing, erotic love, eros, is grounded in a kind of basic neediness, incompletion in human beings. That human beings, as much as they want to convince themselves that they are or could become self-sufficient, independent, are really incomplete and needy, according to this story, and that they spend much of their lives seeking for that one other who will, in some sense or another, complete them. And that love, or erotic love, is, if it has to be defined, a name for the desire for and the pursuit of wholeness. This story has this grotesque presentation of ancient creatures that were once circular and that were then divided in half by the gods and spent their whole lives running around trying to find their other half. And this particular image was supposed to capture this longing in human beings for wholeness or completion, to find the other half and to embrace and seek a kind of union with that other half to achieve an original sense of wholeness. Then we talked about another account of that kind of love that came out of the Middle Ages, romantic love, which defined love as a kind of inborn suffering. This is still erotic love now, kind of inborn suffering that was caused by the excessive meditation on the beauty of the beloved. And we talked there about how the imagination was seen to be central to romantic ardor. We noted how absence on this reckoning makes the heart grow fonder, and that people tend then to pine away for loved ones in their absence, but paradoxically, absences and obstacles, as in all of the great romantic love stories, tend to feed love, tend to deepen it, this kind of romantic ardor. So that in the story of Romeo and Juliet, for example, it's because their families are feuding, because so many people are determined to keep them apart, that their love grows apace. And so we noted, among other things, that this romantic love was a love that often fed on jealousy. The more desirable your beloved was, the more you desired him or her, the more you fretted over the possibility of losing him or her, and the more that kind of fear and fretfulness, and even jealousy at times, fed into and nourished and, in a way, in an odd way, deepened that kind of romantic passion, and that this is the stuff of all kinds of movies. We had the class name their favorite romantic movie, and we noted that almost all of them have people who are jealous or involved in love triangles or having to overcome great obstacles of distance and family strife and different social class or whatever to finally be together. And indeed, for the medievals, or at least for some of them, the ultimate obstacle was often that the person was married to somebody else. That seemed to be an impossible barrier to cross, but often the medieval romances like Lancelot were especially designed around relationships that featured the love of a married woman, Guinevere, for a man, in this case Lancelot, and how much adulterous love was often identified with this kind of romance. So we saw that that kind of love, as the initial kind of love in the Greek description of it, had some difficulties as well as some real positives. This week we talked about friendship, and I think without going into great detail about it, sort of settled on the fact that there are many kinds and levels of friendships, and that we all have at one time enjoyed all of those levels, a kind of chumminess based around a finite common task, as the Mavericks might enjoy up here at Holden for 3 weeks to 6 weeks, but then split up and perhaps never talk to the fellow Mavericks again. But there is a kind of chumminess there around a common venture. But the kind of friendship we talked about most are those that endure, or endure over long periods, that are friendships where you have a kind of mutual well-wishing of one another for their own sake. You wish the best for your friend for his or her own sake, not simply for, or even mainly for, what kind of delights and satisfactions they can bring to you, but you wish them well for the delights and satisfactions that they themselves enjoy, and that's what brings you pleasure. We talked about sustaining those friendships over great distances. We talked about how important a kind of equality was in those friendships, to be the highest and best sort. And we noted how friendships, unlike erotic love attachments, are finally grounded in choice rather than in desire. In other words, friends are often chosen after a kind of careful trial period where one finds oneself deepening into a kind of friendship, unlike love, where we can say, in romantic love, I fell in love at first sight. We noted we don't typically say that we fell into friendship at first sight. And so friendships develop rather differently from love affairs. One of the more interesting dimensions to this conversation that ran through both weeks and that came to a kind of head in the viewing of the movie When Harry Met Sally was the whole question of whether or not men and women in this day and age can be friends in the highest and best sense of friendship without that friendship turning into something else, or as Harry puts it in the movie, without the sex part getting in the way. And there was quite a lot of conversation, not just in these classes, but throughout the village, in which people tried to sort that one out, both in terms of what the movie had to say about it and what their own experience was. And I must say that people didn't come to any general agreement about this, but we noticed, I think, I did anyway, and I've checked with others who noticed the same thing, a kind of generational difference on this question of whether men and women can be friends in the highest and best sense of the word without the sex part getting in the way and turning the thing into something else. And here's the difference. The people who I would say are roughly from the ages of 18 to 30, and that's a very rough 12-year definition, agreed with me when I read a description at the end of last week about what the scene is like on campuses, at least these days, which is that people don't date anymore. They tend to hang around in herds, herds of men and women together, but being very wary about actual courtship, as some of the older generation knew it. This generation seems uncertain about, in the case of dating, who should be pursuing whom, and that makes them reluctant to do that. And they seem kind of wary about the prospect of commitments and much less marriage. They agreed with me when I read them from an article, the statement that the difference between this generation and earlier ones is that earlier ones, the man knew pretty much what he wanted from a woman in marriage, and a woman knew pretty much what she wanted from a man in marriage, and the question that they faced was, would they ever get it? Whereas today, the question is, what do we want? Not whether we'll get it. People not even certain what they want from marriage or what it is. And this plugs into this generational difference about being friends with men and women. Younger people seem to think, well, of course, we have many friends of the opposite sex. This hasn't been a problem for us. How could it be a problem for anybody except an academic who worries over these things? And we notice, though, that what they're lacking is often any kind of primary relationship, that is, any kind of marriage relationship or any kind of intense, serious, committed relationship that's at the center of their lives. Insofar as they've not got one of those, it's relatively more easier for them to forge a variety of fairly close friendships with people of the opposite sex, because the central relationship, which is missing, isn't then in any way threatened by these other things or complicated by them. Contrarywise, a lot of folks who have enjoyed long, enduring, serious, fulfilling, warm, erotic relationships with an important other or a significant other either aren't much interested in the need to forge close, intimate friendships with people of the opposite sex, or found that when that's happened, it has to some degree or another complicated or threatened to undermine the primary relationship, and therefore they tend to report less success or less security in those relationships. So there's that kind of rough, there are exceptions, generational difference on the question of whether or not men and women can be friends. So in sum, however one wants to kind of cut this up, I would say it's fair to say that in the 2 weeks of conversation of Eros and Philia, one has found wonderful things about both of those loves, but one has often found them in some sense lacking, incomplete, presenting often as many difficulties as they do blessings and opportunities. And that opens up the question whether or not this other love, agape, might not be either A, intention with those first two, or B, possibly redemptive of those first two. That is, possibly when it's combined with one or another of the other loves, bringing those other loves to a kind of perfection, or if not to a kind of perfection, to a kind of fulfillment that either love by itself would not have. And that's sort of what I want to explore before opening this up for conversation. I put here on the board a chart
part of which appeared in an earlier class when I contrasted philia, or friendship, to agape, but now I've included eros. And this points up some of the contrasts between and among these three loves. And I'll just review those and then talk a bit about how I think the loves relate or might relate to one another. In the case of philia, friendship, clearly that's a preferential love. We don't simply choose friends at random, nor are we equally friendly with all. In fact, most people who write about friendship and who talked about it here said, when you talk about friendship in the highest and best sense, people have typically one or two, maybe three friends of that sort. Long-term, very intimate, shared a common life together for a long time as roommates or co-workers, whatever. And we clearly, since we ground friendship in choice itself, prefer some to others. We aren't friendly to all people equally. Agape, universal. We are called as Christians to love as God loves, who makes his rain to fall on the evil and the good, the just and the unjust. We are called to love as God loves, who loves us regardless of our merits. It isn't as though God chooses to love us because we are worthy of that love, as is often the case with friendship. We choose to love certain people as our friends because we find something in their character that evokes and calls forth and seems worthy of that kind of love. And so agape, being universal, is right away in tension with friendship because as Christians, we're on the one hand called to love everyone, the universal character of agape, even our enemies, whereas philia is very definitely, as is eros, preferential. Even though eros is grounded in desire, we're often smitten and overcome with the sight of the beloved. We typically aren't smitten and overcome by the sight of everyone, but only some. And so therefore eros, even though it's grounded in desire rather than choice, is still nonetheless restrictive. In fact, of the three, it's probably the most jealous and restrictive. Typically, one has a deep erotic relationship with only one, and if one tries to have a deep erotic relationship that has a sexual dimension to it with more than one, one's headed for some kind of trouble. Friendship, though restrictive, tends to still be larger than eros in that sense, and that friends will often welcome others into the circle, and friendship is not threatened in the same profound way by others joining in the circle of friends as would be true of eros, which is a comparatively jealous love. And so you can see that relative to both philia and eros, agape is really very, very different in those ways with respect to preferential or non-preferential character. Here again, we have some differences, although this time they line up somewhat differently. Here, philia is the odd love out because philia has to be, in order to be friendship, reciprocal. In other words, it doesn't make sense to say that one of my best friends is, let's say, Susan Briel, if Susan Briel is utterly unaware of the fact that I have deep friendly dispositions toward her. We would think, if I said she's one of my best friends and she wasn't even aware of my friendly feelings, that I was nuts. In order to have a friendship with Susan Briel or anyone, it has to be reciprocated. So by its nature, by definition, philia is reciprocal, whereas both eros and agape may be reciprocated. I mean, it may be, ideally, that one's love is returned, one's erotic love, and that one feels agape love toward a person who also feels agape love towards oneself in a Christian community. But it need not be. In other words, agape is often unrequited, not returned. We love even enemies who, by definition, aren't going to return our love in the case of agape. And again, the drugstores are full of dime novels about unrequited love. someone's love for someone else, who never returns that love, never feels the same way toward the lover as he or she does toward the beloved. And so that's the stuff of tragedy. So again, tensions and contrasts. And finally, here again we find agape, the odd love out, by comparison to both eros and philia. Both of these loves are changing. That is to say, in intensity. Erotic love, we learn from the medievals, is always, they say, either waxing or waning, never remains sort of static. And that is due to any number of factors. As one gets older and more familiar with the beloved, according to the medievals, that often decreases the intensity of the passion. But both people in the relationship change, and that kind of change can also change the character of the eros. And the same with the friendship situation. One's dearest and best friends, how many of us haven't had this experience in high school, thinking that we would always be friends with so-and-so and nothing would ever separate us. And even some of us have little rituals like becoming blood brothers and sisters with someone, thinking that we would be friends for life. But one goes away to college and the other doesn't. One has children and the other doesn't. One marries and the other doesn't. Any number of things happen along life's way. We find that we make other friends. We find that friendship, even though it longs for a kind of perpetuity, nonetheless seldom finds it. I mean, we have, each of us maybe in this room, if we've been blessed, some friends that have been of many years standing, but we would all agree that that's rare. So both eros and philia are characterized by change. Again, agape of the three is the one that's steadfast and faithful, because again, agape, Christian love, does not depend upon the character of the neighbor. One of the curious things about Christian love is that though you can lose your beloved, and you can lose your friend, you can never lose your neighbor. And by lose, I mean, I'm not talking about death now, I'm talking about you can lose your beloved because he or she can lose interest in you and seek someone else, move away, change, same with friends. But your neighbor will always be your neighbor, no matter what he or she does. And if we think of the story of the Good Samaritan and the question, who is my neighbor? Everyone is one's neighbor, everyone in need, and therefore, again, there's a kind of universality and steadfastness to agape which these loves simply do not have. Now, to be fair here, there are some things, it seems to me, that at least on this side of eternity, agape lacks. Christian love does not have about it the kind of warmth and intimacy, how could it, if we're called to love enemies, that both philia and eros have. And as we've seen, it lacks the mutuality or reciprocity, agape, frequently, not always, but frequently, that philia possesses. So there are some things about Christian love that it may long for, but is not an essential feature of that kind of love. It may long for a kind of mutuality. The ideal community would be the vast company of friends, which is what the medievals called heaven, in which everyone felt agape for everyone else in God. So that agape finally did have a kind of mutuality to it, which it really doesn't have here on earth. So that helps to supply some of the contrasts. What I now want to suggest is a couple of problems and pose a couple of provisional solutions and then open it up for conversation. Some of the more
serious and severe Christian thinkers, like Kierkegaard, have sometimes even wondered whether or not Christians ought to have friends. By that I mean to say, shouldn't Christians wonder if they're called to love as God loves and to love all people, regardless of their characters, including enemies, and like Good Samaritans, be called to care for even strangers, changing strangers to neighbors through the love that God loves us with? Isn't there something then about the cozy, preferential character of friendship, which is not only relatively exclusive, just a few circle of friends, but also whereby our friends have a kind of superior claim upon our time, our talents, and our treasures to other anonymous folks out there? Isn't there something even anti-Christian about friendship, in that A, it's exclusive, and B, we prefer our friends, give them first place in doling out our finitude in time, talent, and treasure, and might we not therefore be acting in an unchristian way in having that kind of preferential treatment for some? So there's a problem I'm just going to let sit there for a minute, because it illustrates what I mean about some people's thinking that these loves are not reconcilable, but stand sometimes in fairly fundamental tension with one another. I think that to pose then a provisional sort of comment to get conversation going about how one might address at least the one contrast I just brought up, some thinkers, St. Augustine in particular, have thought that really when we come to something like friendship, we are apt to expect too much from it and to distort it, unless we as Christians see friendship as itself a gift from God, where we come to love our friends as given to us by God, and B, see that though we are called to love universally in agape, also recognize that our finite character as creatures places us in particular places where we can only have limited face-to-face contact with a few, so that if we regard friendship, people that we select from that few that we're placed in the midst of, as a kind of training for the ultimate love, as a kind of sign of what the ultimate perfect love would look like, agape with an inner mutuality like friendship, a training in that love, and a pointing toward it, we can, as Christians, enjoy friendship without feeling that it is somehow in fundamental tension with agape. Provided one thing, and that is that we don't make idols out of our friends, that we order our loves properly and not place too much weight either on our lovers or on our friends as being that which finally satisfies. In other words, if we intend to have our lives completed utterly and fully by our beloved, in the case of the lover, or by our friend, in case of the best friend, then we clearly are disordering our loves. We are basically putting on those finite other creatures, who are also parts of God's creation, more love than we should. And we learn this bitterly when those friends and those lovers change or die, in that we have basically invested so much of ourselves and so much of our hopes and so much of our longings in them that our restless hearts are not satisfied unless they rest, as Augustine put it, in God. So that agape, in Augustine's view, actually is a broad context which helps to repair and strengthen other loves, which by themselves, absent agape, can become distorted and often disabling rather than enabling. Is that clear, that kind of argument about how agape tends to strengthen rather than to undermine or to judge the other two loves up there? I give it a couple of illustrations, but okay, let me just stop and see if there are questions or comments about what I've said. Yes.
Something I'm kind of, several things that I'm quite curious about, but one of them that I'm curious about is whether, by definition, it's possible to be into an agape-type situation if the person on the other side actually has a name. In other words, my neighbor is Brad Woodham. I'm friendly, we wave, we trade garbage back and forth, we pick up the bear shit together, we do. The bear gets into his garbage and drags it over my yard, and we both pick it up, and we're very friendly back and forth. Is that by definition into the agape situation, or are you only into an agape situation when it is by definition somebody that doesn't have a name? In other words,
I understand.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear from some others? The question is, in a way, does agape operate only when people are anonymous? That is to say, we extend agape to people who don't have names. Whereas if they do have a name and identity and we're related to them in some other way, is that automatically some kind of other love, like friendship or chumminess, or isn't that what you're asking?
Well, I'm not particularly chums with my neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Except that if he quit picking up your garbage and doing his share, then it does. Then it's changing. Then it doesn't fit that steadfast faith piece, because then that would, in you, bring up some other kind of...
Yeah. We're not particularly friends. We're just next door neighbors.
But friends encompasses more than we agree upon this relationship. Friends, I think, can extend to the neighbor where you're mutually doing things. If he quits doing it and you still do it, you don't hate his guts. Maybe that's a copy.
Yes.
That's correct.
But isn't agape by definition unconditional?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So she's being unconditional.
So I would say that the beloved in agape could and often does have a face and a name. Your love for your children is unconditional. Hopefully, the love for your parents is also unconditional. Sometimes that's even more difficult. So I would say that Christ knows our face. He's our example, and we receive agape love from Him.
Nice point. It's interesting, by the way, to notice to figure out the one kind of love that's not named up here and that should be perhaps the fourth kind is the kind of love of parents for children and children for parents. In other words, I think people have been uncertain what to call that or whether to call it a fourth kind of love, because it seems to partake of, at different stages in development anyway, one or all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem yet identical with any one of them, and you've already opened up one area where it looks very much like agape, that is the unconditional character of parents' love for their children and children's love for their parents, which is frequently unconditional in a way that philia and eros are not.
Well, we're commanded by God to honor our parents.
Right.
Where does the word like fit in? You know, you can like a person.
Mm-hmm.
They're not your friend. You're not in love with them. So would that be... But you like them a lot. You know, you like them. So would that fit in under agape?
I think probably not. Liking folks would probably be a kind of general affection, a kind of friendly disposition toward people. And it's that larger matrix out of which true friends ultimately develop. So friendship then would become a very particularized and exclusive relationship that was born out of this generally larger matrix of friendliness and liking.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. In one example, I think of agape, where the person can have a face, as if you are a member of a team working in a soup kitchen, where you see the same people all the time and you unconditionally, you know, do for them, or you work in the hospital and, you know, put time there, you unconditionally help in whatever means, you know, you're able to in that situation. They have a name, they have a face, you see them again and again and again, and it's definitely agape because it's your service to them, and maybe you're getting nothing in return, and hopefully you are, but that would be a face in the name.
One important difference for me, although you said agape is either unrequited or reciprocal, is that there's not an expectation of reciprocation.
Mm-hmm.
To me, agape is very much an act of volition and of choice without the expectation of something coming back.
Yes.
Whereas in the other two, it either there either is reciprocal or you hope it is.
Yes, good point. Nobody hear that?
Mm-hmm. No.
Nice point, yes.
No expectation.
You can't have agape love if you have if you are showing it toward another with the expectation that love will be returned. The tricky thing there is philia. Some writers think that in getting a friendship started, if you extend friendship to another with only in the expectation and only for the reason that you want that love returned, chances are the friendship won't ever get started. That even the beginnings of a friendship implies a certain kind of willingness to extend yourself selflessly, okay? And so that at least in getting a friendship started, you need something like an agapeistic selflessness. Because if you wait around to extend love to the other and trust to the other until they've proven themselves lovable and trustworthy, oftentimes that'll never happen, okay? And so that you need something like agape to get it started. But it is true that you wouldn't have, once it is started, real philia unless it was reciprocated, as I said. Whereas in agape, you could have a lifetime of that moving only one way and still call it agape, even if it were never reciprocated. Yes.
No, I seem to be, this is triggering all kinds of things for me. One of the things that I'm curious about from this point of view is you've used agape and Christian love synonymously. Mm-hmm. Is there not Jewish agape, Buddhist agape? Agape was around a heck of a long time before Christianity was around, at least according to the Greeks, wouldn't it be?
They have the word for it, yes.
It certainly was there. It was certainly in their system of things.
It isn't really clear, actually, that though the Greeks have the word, it seems that to people like Plato and Aristotle and Homer and so on, and the tragic poets, the kind of call to love enemies would have been utterly inconceivable.
Mm-hmm.
Utterly inconceivable. I mean, that you could actually, treating them with a certain dignity, returning the dead body of the enemy so that it can be given a decent burial, showing a certain basic decency, yes, that was part of the Homeric code. And one can find instances in which enemies come to a deep mutual regard and respect for one another as human beings who are mortal and so forth and so on. But the kind of self-giving love that we're called to extend to enemies in the New Testament, and which is the kind of pattern of Jesus' own life and witness, That you won't find much of an analog to in and among the Greeks. I'm not enough of a expert in comparative religion to know whether or not one would find something identical to that within Buddhism and Confucianism and some of the other great world religions. I suspect you would find some disciplines and ethical values that come very close to that. But basically, I think what's unusual about the Christian agape is precisely this universal and steadfast character that even enemies is both the limiting case and the most relevant case, because it shows that you are even called to love those who persecute and revile and would seek to kill you, which is a pretty radical call to love. And it's grounded, of course, in, as I said at the very beginning, it's grounded finally in, both in terms of the example and in terms of what empowers us even to be able to do it, in the way that God first loved us. Because had God not loved us in this way, and were it not for God within us, we couldn't love others by ourselves in that way. It would seem both psychologically impossible and I think morally beyond our grasp, except that God first loved us in that way and continues to. So I think there's something pretty distinctively Christian about that, though I will admit that as far as Buddhism and some of the other religions you mentioned are concerned, I just don't have enough knowledge to know whether or not there are things in those traditions that are identical. There may be.
From a Jewish standpoint, yeah. I'm no Old Testament scholar, but my sense of the Old Testament is there's a lot there about the moral imperative to care for the poor, but not very much about loving your enemies. Usually it's asking God to come crush your enemies or do away with them. Mm-hmm. So that is quite a difference.
Yeah, the widows and the orphans were constantly called in the great prophets to care for those who are marginal and who are in need. That's the community's responsibility. Mm-hmm. There's certainly that kind of neighbor love. But you're right, when it comes to enemies, I think that teaching Jesus' fellow Jews found quite radical.
And yet when you think of, for example, Mohandas Gandhi, mm-hmm. who certainly was not a Christian.
Correct.
But his whole... his version of agape certainly included loving the British.
Mm-hmm. No, his whole teaching of satyagraha is very very close to agape. And that comes out of a Hindu, tradition, although he did certainly have an awful lot of interaction with folks in the West, back and forth, and I think the influences work both ways, people in the West on Gandhi and Gandhi on people in the West. But there's no question that he was a spiritual genius, and his own nonviolent love and his own model that he set in what he did and how he lived and what he said is very close. And people have noticed that. Mm-hmm. I should say, lest I give you the wrong impression, that there have been some very impressive Christian thinkers who have thought that either one or both of those two loves are in a kind of fundamental conflict with agape. There's a great bishop, former bishop of Sweden, named Anders Nygren, N-Y-G-R-E-N, who wrote a big, thick book tracing out the motifs of Eros and Agape. In fact, that's the title of the book, Agape and Eros, throughout Western history, and basically finds them gods. Eros striving for union with the divine by reaching up, agape having God reaching down, initiating the action of love and reaching down to the creature. Eros being a kind of love that is grounded, as I said, in a kind of desire and that seeks completion of an earthly sort and that tends automatically toward a kind of idolatry then. And agape pointing us toward the fact that we are needy and dependent creatures who are not going to find a resting place for our hearts unless they rest in God and unless God makes the first move, etc., etc. And this little book, which I would recommend, which I think is the best on the relationship between philia, or friendship, and agape, was written by Gilbert Mylander, and I'll leave it up here if you want to copy the name. It's called Friendship, A Study in Theological Ethics, and he does some wonderful things about the relationship between friendship and agape. And it's a couple of his suggestions I have borrowed from him to set out here. One was the one about how friendships actually get started only with something like agape in the first stirrings of friendship. And another one, his point about how if we love the friend in Christ or love the friend in God and construe it as a kind of sign and a calling for the heavenly situation, the vast friendship of heaven, we can in good conscience be Christians and also have close friends, even though initially it appears that that might be problematic for Christians, singling out some and preferring some to others in the disposition of our times, our talents, and our treasures. Yes.
With agape being a Greek word, how was it originally translated into English?
Oh, it's always translated just love.
Love, period.
Love, period. Mm-hmm.
And yet, apparently for the Greeks, it meant something quite different than it did post-Christ.
That's right. It had, the Greeks have simply, as do many other languages, a richer vocabulary for the affections than we do when we use love to cover all of those things. In fact, the most famous case of it that most of you probably know about is the translation in the King James when Peter is reinstated after his three times denial. When Jesus asks him three times, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And so the English translation is always, lovest thou me, lovest thou me, lovest thou me? But if you know the Greek, you see that each time Jesus has used a different word. Do you eros me? Do you philia me? Do you agape me? So that it's not simply a repetition three times, like the denial was three times. Each is asking for a different kind and level of love there. And we don't pick that up in English because we have the same word all three times. It's just as though Jesus is kind of repeating the same question three times over. It's actually a very different question each one of those three times, which you miss in the English translation. Any other questions or observations? I think we've gone a little bit over time, or do you have 11:30? We do have time for more questions or concerns. Yes.
It seems to be disappointing me in a number of places. When you first were talking about having chosen the topic of friendship,
yes,
as part of your response,
yes,
to the theme of no longer strangers, you were positing as the two sides, friends, strangers.
Mm.
Or love, lovers, in whatever sense, strangers. And yet, typically when you ask somebody what's the opposite of love, you don't get stranger, you get hate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to comment on that at all?
I think that's quite right. I think that there are a number of ways in which along the way these 2 weeks we've discovered that alienation and estrangement on the one hand and love and friendship on the other aren't quite the opposites that they originally appear to be. For instance, I think in the case of agape, as I said today, you could say without much, I think, distortion that it's agape that changes all strangers into neighbors. Not into friends, Not in the lovers, certainly, but in the neighbors, which is a very different term from stranger. I mean, it's when the Good Samaritan passes the man who's fallen among thieves, he's a stranger, but in the way that he treats him makes him a neighbor, okay? Because the whole context of that story is, who is my neighbor? So that, in a sense, it's only agape that when we come to the population of the world, you can actually talk about sensibly as having an effect upon those who are strange to us in a way that lovers and friends is only going to affect, you know, a few finite human beings who we are placed in the midst of. Another thing that I think is true, and I quoted Norman MacLean's line from River Runs Through It, which is a wonderful examination of a love within a family, and the minister who is the father in that story preaches a sermon after the one brother has died, and he and the surviving brother can never make sense out of that man's life and what drove him and what motivated him and so on. And in the sermon is simply the statement, it's those who are the closest to us and whom we love the most deeply who are often the ones who elude us more than those who are relatively strange to us. Mm-hmm. Some have said that we are strangers even to ourselves in some deep and profound way, that it's only God who can know our heart, that even we can't know it. Mm-hmm. So that what first looked to me and to others as though it was opposites actually blend into one another in very mysterious ways, and I've given you two examples. So that's by the way of supporting what you were really asking about. Yes?
Oh, I think it was Eric Fromm said the opposite of love is not hate, it's apathy. Because with hate there is a relationship, even though it's bad. With apathy, we're taking people for granted. Mm-hmm.
Apathy or indifference.
Yeah.
Nice point. I just have one last question that you started to open up, or maybe it was you, about families. Where would you put family love on the chart? Or would you think we'd need to start another column? In particular, parents to children and children to parents.
You'd probably have to put a
phone
down to the bottom.
So it would be a kind of a blend, some from some and some from others.
Okay. It's constantly shifting. Mm-hmm. The mix. You can't do the same recipe today that you did yesterday.
That's right. An illustration would be that many people say they have become, at a certain magic point in their life, which they're grateful for, friends with their parents. But that would have been silly to talk about when they were totally dependent at age 3 to 10, and the parent was clearly superior and the source of income and sustenance and everything else. But once the son or the daughter have become themselves economically and in otherwise mature, oftentimes what began as a kind of familial love, or filial with an F, filial love, blossoms into a friendship. That would be one example.
Wouldn't that love be agape because it says it unrequited?
Unrequited.
Or, mm-hmm. Unrequited. Or steadfast and faithful. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that go under that, irrespective what stage you're in, whether you're in the friendship stage or not, you still love.
Mm-hmm. No, that's quite right. Mm-hmm. And that's what your point was about unconditionality. In fact, one of the things, by the way, that people are bioethicists worried about in this whole cloning and making perfect babies issue, not just through cloning, but through all of the biotechnologies where you begin to be able to select for sex and select for and perform gene therapy and that whole business. One of the things that worries some of them, including Mylander, whose major field is bioethics, they would argue something like this, that where is the place on earth that we are schooled in what agape is? Now, obviously, it's the church in the sense that it's there we learn the stories and there we are baptized and so on. But where through daily experience do we learn what it's like to love agapeistically first? And these ethicists would say it's in families, for the reason that there we love not because we chose this person to be our parent or that person to be our son, but because that's what we were given. And we learn to love what we've been given, not what we chose. And we learn to love unconditionally, okay? Now, the problem is once you begin to see babies not as gifts but as products that you kind of design in a laboratory, then the whole relationship changes as though now they're ours by choice. We made them. They're not gifts from God. And we got to kind of design them instead of learning to love what we were given because it's gift. And so one of the worries by some ethicists about this whole effort to make the perfect baby is that what we will lose is the whole school whereby we've learned importantly to love agapeistically, because we've seen one another as gifts and have learned to love what we've been given rather than what we ourselves have chosen and made. You follow that argument?
I totally disagree with
that. Yeah, I'm not sure it's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
I think that's extremely prideful and arrogant.
In what way?
We created something. We maybe changed the creation. We had some effect on the creation. But without God, is there a spirit in that new human being? Do we learn agape love? I think it's like a conscience. I think it's something that's given by God. We can receive it through faith. But to say that we created life, I think is extremely arrogant.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, that's the vocabulary that is used by some of the people.
Yeah, so, but what I'm saying is on the face of it, I think that statement is not a Christian view of life or godly love.
And that's not giving license to do the calling. Experimentation. It's just, it would still be a beat from God. However, we adjust things right now.
Do you think that the cloning, though, if it turns out to be a genetic duplicate of the parent, such that it comes into the world freighted then with a certain definite set of expectations. For example, if we were to clone Michael Jordan, let me just take a comic example here. If we were to clone Michael Jordan and he were to decide he wanted to be a concert violinist and had no interest in basketball, to take an extreme case, don't you think that that would have a kind of effect on his upbringing? He wouldn't be a new creature, he would be a copy of a creature who's already lived, etc. And wouldn't that change the whole character of the relationship between, and confound, in other words, the relationship between mother and child and so forth, in ways that would be disturbing, or do you think we would just be able to treat that the same way?
Does the parent have an agape love for that child? If they do, they're not going to place expectations on that child.
But why would they do that in the first place, though? Why would they?
Well, no. It's the same. You clone Michael Jordan, and someone raises this child, and they have an expectation it's going to be another Michael Jordan. Well, if they really love that child, they're going to let it grow and pursue its own path. They're not going to. I mean. All kinds of parenting classes talk about how you don't put your expectations on your child. You don't push your child in the direction you want them to go.
You let them clone find their way. And you didn't want another Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
What's that?
You wouldn't clone Michael Jordan if you didn't want another Michael Jordan.
See, I think that is the problem. The dilemma is, why would you have cloned him to begin with if you didn't want another great basketball player. I mean, you would then just have gone about making babies sort of the way they've been made and love them and so on. Once you start to, my point is that even though I think you're ultimately right, theoretically it would be possible to extend agape to these fabricated beings. My point is, the more you have a hand in fabricating them for these motives, the more that threatens your ability, it seems to me, not to freight them with those sort of expectations. So it's just
No, that's very true.
Yeah, that's all I mean. Okay, sorry I kept you over time.
Thank you.